From DogWorks Radio Network, sponsored by Alaska DogWorks, Professional Canine Training Center in Anchorage, Alaska. This is the DogWorks Radio Show, committed to families and their dogs to build lifelong and fulfilling relationships. Visit our website at dogworksradio.com. DogWorks Radio is part of the one and only 24-hour internet radio network dedicated to dogs. Now, here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to DogWorks Radio here from Willow, Alaska. It is a beautiful fall day up here in Alaska, and on the line we have calling in from Delaware, Ohio, which is just north of Columbus, Scotty McConaughey, and he is the owner and lead trainer at Canine Ponderosa. Scotty, how's it going?
Robert Forto, how are you, sir?
I am good, thank you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are and what you're all about.
And the pronunciation is McConaughey. Everybody gets it wrong, so don't worry about that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
I said, just tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are and what you're all about.
Well, my name is Scotty McConaughey, and I own the Canine Ponderosa in Delaware, Ohio. And it's a dog training behavior modification ranch, 20 acres. We deal with a lot of dogs that are problem dogs. We also just train regular old happy-go-lucky dogs. And a lot of times we, most every Saturday, we give a puppy preschool for puppies that are under the age of 16 weeks.
So how long have you been in the dog training business, Scott?
Well, my whole life I've been training dogs, but I would say strongly about 10 years.
And do you have anything in particular that you work on? What is your specialty? I know we talked about puppies preschool, and we're going to get into that a little bit more. But do you have one thing that folks seek you out for?
Well, you know, everybody has their thing that they're good at, and I would feel like I'm very good at creating a good family dog. So I try to train the dog so that it's easy for the owner to go home with the language of obedience and then manage unwanted behaviors. And then, you know, it's just as important to make sure the dog is balanced so that they understand they have to walk their dog, run their dog. They have to give their dog some kind of an adventure or their dog's going to start to create the adventure in the house. And so We focus on the training, yes, but we also try to get the dog balanced, and it should be a nice flow. The training should be a nice flow right into the house, and I do offer a home visit with my training program. So usually what I do is I bring a dog in 2 to 3 weeks, and then we do the go-home lesson. They get 3 follow-up lessons. They get a lifetime of advice, and if they need one home visit, then I do the home visit, and that's the gold. That's when it all comes together, because a lot of times what trainers do is they send the owner's home, and the dog is trained, but they don't know how to use that training to apply to everyday life.
Right. You know, that's something that we struggle with up here with our camps or our board and trains. The folks see the results, and then they feel that they just don't have to do the work when they get home, and that's not the case, is it?
Right. No, and sometimes it's just a situation. It could be a mom with 3 kids, you know, and so a very active family, and or somebody who may be, have a sickness like cancer or something, and they just can't, you know, step up. So that's where you have to hold their hand, and I will hold people's hands. And that's, you know, that's just me. But I'm also now, these days, I'm a little picky about who I train for, because my name goes on the dog, and I want to make sure that they go home with a solid dog. And then, most of my business is word of mouth. I don't really do any advertising.
Right. You know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, Scotty, I know we had you on at least a year ago now. It's been quite a while. But one of the things I'm interested in talking to you about are kind of the trends in dog training. You know, as a trainer for many years, you've seen things come and go throughout the years. Can you explain a little bit to our listeners what are some of the trends that are working today and possibly some that aren't?
Trends. Well, I would say that the e-collar, if used correctly by a professional, can be quite the miracle for a dog, especially a family. And that way you can allow the husky to go run and be a husky, or the Rhodesian Ridgeback to go down the trails without running off and chasing a rabbit. But, the professionals know how to use the e-collar very humanely on a very low level, so it's a language. And it's just priceless because, like you said, the high-caliber dogs that will run away, you can let them get off leash with confidence, and you can control them. And a lot of times when, you know, I train probably more women than I do men, and they'll come down the driveway and they'll have two or three kids and maybe a dog or two, and a lot of them are not open to the e-collar. But then when I show them how gentle it is, they go, oh, you know what, I like this. And then next thing you know, they go home, and they're now they're walking around the woods with their dog off leash, and then that's how I get my business. People see that, and then they she recommend, or the people will recommend other people to me, and that's how I get my business.
Right. And, you know, that's not necessarily a new trend. That's been around for years. Is that type of training, is it pretty easy to transfer back to the client? And I bring that up because a lot of things that that occurred, you know, even in the early 90s, early 2000s, a lot of people were doing the clicker training. And timing was off for a lot of dog owners. They didn't know exactly when to click and, of course, when to treat. So it became very frustrating to the owner, especially if they didn't have a lot of follow-up guidance. Are you seeing that same thing with the collar, the e-collars, or is it a pretty easy learning curve for the owners?
Well, I would say, you know, with today's technology, the remote collars are real fine. You can tune them right in and make it real comfortable for the dog. And it's not like the old days with the e-collar. In the old days, they were hot with the e-collar. They would, you know, turn it up real high to get the dog to do unwanted behaviors. But what we do is we use on low levels, and we use a long line to help the dog understand. And then sometimes we apply a few treats here and there. And so we do a little bit of all positive training, but, you know, we mix the remote collar, we mix the choke chain, we mix the prong collar. We use every tool. And there's an old saying, the treat's not going to get a dog out of the street. And that's true. But the remote collar, a dog will stop on a dime and come right directly to you. Now, I know how to, and I have many times trained many dogs on just a long line, and that is super solid too, but the e-collar trumps everything. It's immediately the dog will stop on a dime and return. Also, you can teach things like no street, no kitchen, no couch very easily without turning the e-collar up very high. You just use low-level taps and use at least the once the dog is introduced to it correctly, then you can use the leash to help the dog understand what you want. I don't want you in the kitchen. Tap, 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 no kitchen. And then you use the leash to help them understand, to lean out of the kitchen. And next thing you know, they're hanging out right on the edge of the kitchen. It's beautiful.
Right. You know, we're going to get into some pack-type behavior here in just a second, Scotty. But I'm interested in learning about your puppy preschool. You had mentioned how important that was before we went on air. What's your advice on that? We are firm believers that puppy training should start the minute you get your dog.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, we believe that everything a dog learns under the age of 16 weeks is 90% of what he draws on for the rest of his life. So you're basically formatting a hard drive, and we try to expose dogs to vacuum cleaners and noises and going through tunnels and getting on crinkly little tarps and getting on tippy tables. We also work on the come command right when they walk in the door. That's the first thing we work on is the come command, because that's the most valued command. That's the command that can save your dog's life. And then we have to help them with unwanted nipping and biting. We don't allow teeth on flesh. So we've come a long way. I've taught so many now that I can basically do it in my sleep. And now I'm just now getting to the point where I can actually enjoy the classes, because it is very much controlled chaos. Because when you have 10 puppies in a room and they're all under 16 weeks of age and they're just, you know, one dog's going after another, or another dog's going to go potty, or somebody's older and they might be falling over their coffee. So you have to be like a quarterback and see the field whenever you're teaching a puppy preschool. But it really is priceless, because it brings the pup into the game of life very quickly.
What is your recommendation for the start of a class? Are you a 12-week guy? Are you a under 6-month guy? What's your typical enrollment period?
Well, I feel that they can come in here at 8 weeks. I do like to see them, you know, in the house for 10 days if possible, and they have to, you know, they can't come in here with a kennel cough or worms or anything like that. But it seems like we're getting more and more puppies starting to show up. So, you know, the more you do it, like every Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, it starts to become known and people start spreading the word. And so now we don't really do any advertising, and puppy preschools are getting booked up. And, you know, it's just priceless. And then you train the dog, and the dog goes home, and then maybe 3 or 4 years later you see the dog, and the dog comes flying up on you and loves on you. And it's just, that's pretty cool stuff.
So where you're at, Scotty, at the Canine Ponderosa there in Delaware, I would imagine that most of your clients would be your folks in the suburbs of Columbus, more urban-type people. Is that true?
Well, I would say it is true, but I get people from all over, people from other states, people drive a long way. You know, they have to – usually I know, and then I'll make an attempt to greet them. If they drove 4 hours to get here or something like that, I know it's important to them. If somebody drives 2 hours or an hour, or 4 hours, you know that's pretty serious stuff. So you have to, if I know they're serious, then I can help them. If they want it, I'll want it. That's how it kind of works in dog training.
So let's talk a little bit about pack type of behavior. I know that you went to Cesar Millan's training school or program that they offer there. I'm definitely interested in talking to you about that because there's so much information out there, especially on social media, about the pros and cons of that type of training. Can you give us a little bit of your experience in that type of training? And then, of course, I have several questions about that.
Sure. Well, with Cesar, I really I almost wished I would have went to see Cesar before I did all my other training, because that would have saved me a lot of battles. And now I don't battle. I help more than anything. And then you have to read the dog. So, Cesar is really good at the energy reading. I guess to keep it simple, you could say there's three steps to a dog's drive. There's pack drive, where they're happy-go-lucky hanging out. There's prey drive, where they see the rabbit. And there's engage, where they go after the rabbit. And so, that he's really a master at intercepting that and seeing it. But he's also got a great dog energy inside. I mean, he's just really mellow, and then the dogs pick up on that. I think I've seen him one time. He walked into a room with a whole bunch of dogs, and not one of them barked at him. And I was like, wow, that guy is dog.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I thought we dropped off there. Why do you think that there's so much of a bad press about that type of training? You see it all the time about how folks should steer away from that type of training of their dogs. How, what's your opinion of that?
Well, no matter what you do, somebody's going to complain. So, it's not, if you go meet Cesar, you will probably be very touched how good of a guy he is and how much he loves dogs. And he knows how to make the dogs happy. It's not by loving them all the time. And your dog needs an adventure. I mean, you know that more than anybody with all your mushing. They need to get out there and run, and then when they come home, they're happy, It's sitting on the couch, all this love, and they don't get an adventure, so they create a lazy adventure, sitting on the couch, growling at somebody that walks by. Guess what? I own that now. And so is he getting a bum rap? Yes, he's getting a bum rap. He cares. And so he's got a big heart for dogs, and he can read people incredibly well. And I'm going to stand by him. I'm going to stand by just about any dog trainer. I don't really like to bash any dog trainer, especially if they're getting good results. And I think the role of the guy.
So is that type of training, that pack type training, or that the energy type training, as you mentioned, is that one of those types of training that's easily transferred back to the owner? Does it take quite a bit of work on their part?
Yeah, that's a good question. It is not easily transferred. You have a mom who's got three children, and two of them are doing soccer, one is doing dance, and she's flying around, trying to get things done, and maybe she even has a job. So, people come in here and they're on the move, and they got places to go, people to meet, and things to do. So how do you slow them down? It's really not easy. And some people pick it up. And then usually, though, as long as I talk to them, sometimes I will talk about Cesar, and they will listen, and as long as it makes a little bit of an effect on them. So why is the dog pulling me when I get outside? Well, maybe when you got your dog out of the kennel, you got your dog out of the kennel in an excited state of mind. It all starts right there at the kennel.
Right. So one of the things that is a big part of that type of training is free running and pack type behavior, and allow dogs to sort things out amongst themselves. We do that all the time here with our sled dogs. I'm a firm believer that they are their own teachers most of the time. What is your opinion of that, kind of free-running socialization, letting the dogs figure things out for themselves?
Well, I did learn a lot from Heather Beck. She came out here and did a workshop at the Canine Ponderosa, and she ran a social, which was I thought was unbelievably outstanding, and it was really good for the dogs and really good for the owners. Yeah, I think you're right. Dogs do help other dogs figure it out, but we're not going to let dogs fight to the death or anything like that. There's not going to be, let's let them work it out in a fight, because they'll fight. Dogs will fight to the death. And so, you know, barring that, then yes, you're right. Dogs do, and, you know, it's a beautiful thing. One of my head trainers went out and got a mini Australian cattle dog, and this dog's a little shark. He's very sweet, but he's also a little shark. And so I knew my one border collie had bite inhibition, which means he was taught not to bite as a puppy, how to control his bite pressure. And we brought Oreo and into his border collie, brought him into the training center. Then we brought the Australian cattle dog in, Scrappy is his name, and we let him go at it. And basically Oreo pinned the dog a few times, warned the dog, pinned the dog, and then in the end the dog left Oreo alone and learned not to jump on Oreo and latch on with the teeth. And it was really quite beautiful. And to be honest with you, I didn't even know my dog had that in him. It was really a beautiful thing to see, to see another dog teach another dog. There's nothing better than nature. A human can do that in many different ways, but there's nothing better than nature to teach a puppy bite pressure or bite inhibition.
And what about the free run, the pack run, the exercise amongst other dogs? I'm again a big believer that most dogs don't get the exercise or the socialization that they should. You know, most dogs are sedentary. They're in their backyard. They're in the house, on the couch, whatever. They don't get the socialization that they should. What's your opinion of that?
Well, in my opinion is a puppy should see 200 people before the age of 8 weeks and 400 people before the age of 12 weeks. And, you know, this is a great time when they're puppies to have parties and have people coming over wearing funny hats, and maybe somebody comes in dragging their leg or stomping loudly or walking quietly and being suspicious. And then you have a little treat bowl and walk over, get the treat, and give it to the dog. So this all becomes normal. So, you know, and then a lot of times what people make the mistake of, well, they'll do that. Very rarely do people really do that, but when they do that and they're on it, then what happens is right around 5 months old, they stop socialization because they think that they've already done their job with the socialization, but actually socialization needs to go on for many years, you know, even 2, 3, 4 years sometimes.
It's very close to a human child on how they interact with kids. And, you know, if they don't get that socialization that they should at school and go to the dances and play the sports and all that, they're not going to be as well-rounded as their peers, at least in my opinion. I believe that's the same with dogs.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I've taken on the worst of the worst. I've trained a dog that was born and raised in a barn, and it was never let out of the barn until it was 8 months old, and that was like training Helen Keller. You know, it was terrified of buildings and even water and even a tennis ball. And so what I did was I just used other dogs, because it did spend some time with the mother and the litter mates. I used other dogs to bring that dog out of his shell. And then, you know, and nothing, the genetics of a dog's kick in when you go on a pack run. When your dog is running with the pack and you're going through trails and you're on the move, no matter what, you know, the genetics kick in and the dog starts to feel good. But, you know, and I even have a dog in right now that it's a stray, but I can guarantee you that dog was probably isolated early, you know, for maybe even like 8 months of its life. Or maybe a dog that we had in here that was 7 years old, spent 7 years in a pen mating and never had been out. And this dog was terrified of the world. So these are the super hard dogs, and heartbreaking as it is, you can only do so much with those dogs because it's hardwired. But that's why we believe in the puppy preschool, because you can do a fantastic job of influencing their behaviors and with the socialization at a young age.
You know, Scotty, that's a great point that you brought up about you can only do so much. We hear all the time from the pet owners that say, oh, we rescued Max from the shelter or whatever, and we don't want to be hard on him. We don't want to do anything that's going to disrupt his life. He's had such a hard life already. What do you say to those folks that that are a little bit leery of training because of the background of the dog, whether it be a shelter or, as you mentioned, something like a breeding pen?
Well, most dogs that are shelter dogs have not been abused, but they have been abused in the fact that they weren't socialized or they were just kept in the kennel all the time. So, and then, you know, you have a good owner, a nice person trying to do well, and they go out and they get a dog, they want to rescue a dog, and then they see the dog in the kennel, and the dog's shaking or whatever, or being a little bit fearful, because most of them are, and then they come home, and then they're trying to baby the dog. So you want to love last with a dog. I like to run. I like to run a dog, then train a dog, and then love a dog. And if you do it in that order, you won't get in trouble. But what happens is they love the dog first, and that's not meeting the dog's true genetic desires to go run and get movement, and you know, be with other dogs. I have used other dogs. I remember a long time ago a trainer telling me he didn't think other dogs could help other dogs, and now I know that that's not true. Because I do it a lot, and dogs help other dogs dramatically.
You mentioned love a dog first. I think that that humans are hardwired to think that way, especially with our human counterparts, our kids and our family. It's tough to take that out of the equation first, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, if I am teaching a class and somebody goes, "Aw," they see a dog just standing there and they're feeling sorry for the dog, that one statement, "Aw," it echoes through the whole building and now everybody's feeling sorry for the little dog. And the reality is, you know, pity locks pain. We're not going to be able to help the dog if we're feeling sorry for it. And you need to be a leader. So you bring home a rescue dog, you got to lead. You know, grab that leash, let's go for a walk. You know, entertain the dog. Basically, you're going to have to entertain, give the dog an adventure, but movement is everything, you know. So you come home and you're feeling sorry for the dog, you know, and you start loving the dog, giving treats. And a lot of times, rescue dogs, I'm telling you, a pretty high percentage will come home and they go through a honeymoon period where they're all fine and dandy, and then all of a sudden they start showing their true personality where they own the couch or they own their food aggressive. Or, you know, they cage aggression starts to show up. So that's and then they come see me, and then there's a whole new world, you know. Sometimes, and I've learned a lot over the years about bite inhibition and about the level of a dog bite. So if a dog bites and rips and tears, you know, can I help that dog, you know? Who knows? If it's a friendly dog, I could possibly help it, but this dog has proven that it will bite and rip and tear versus a dog that may growl at somebody and act all, you know, aggressive but not really bite and latch on, which that tells me this dog has bite inhibition. The dog won't bite them. You know, if put into a corner, will a dog bite you or will a dog throw a big hissy fit, you know? So the dog that will bite and rip and tear, that's the one that we're concerned about. That's the one we can help them all. But at some point, you have to tell the owner that you can only train the dog to manage unwanted behaviors because, you know, if a child is running and falls on a dog that does not have bite inhibition, that dog can turn and bite and rip and tear versus a dog that does have bite inhibition and the child falls on them, they'll throw a big hissy fit and it will look bad maybe, but the dog did not bite and rip. See what I'm saying? So I don't want to be vested in a dog that I know has an explosive, you know, trait of aggression.
So you, as well as I know, Scotty, that we can do what we can with dogs, but almost always, usually the second question from a client is how much is it going to cost? How do you explain that to your clients? I know that's one of the most difficult things to get across to them is, okay, well, this is what we can do for you, but this is what it's going to cost. How do you explain that to your clients?
Well, what I do is I let the client tell me. If I see somebody that's sincere and they really care and then you help them and you'll come down on price for them because you need to sell to them the way they need to be sold to. And there's all kind of different personalities. And, you know, I just recently got an email from a lady that doesn't have any money. And I tried to push her towards another young, very good dog trainer whose prices are lower. And she's not interested, and so I'm going to help her. And, you know, so as a pro dog trainer, if you are successful, you need to do one project dog every month. So every month you need to take a dog and need to rehab it, or you need to help somebody who doesn't have any money. And so that's my way of giving back, and it makes me feel good, you know. So and that's it's really all about doing the right thing. I mean, when I go to bed, you know, I want to make sure that I did right by the dog and I can sleep at night. And that's what I do. I try as hard as I can to be true to the dog and true to the client. I don't worry about advertising and word of mouth. Everything is coming around and it's looking really good these days.
So one other thing, we talked a little bit about trends in dog training. What is the trend these days in terms of breed? You see that often cycle in and out. You know, one period it was the Golden Doodles and the Labradoodles, and then it was the little dogs for a little while. Then, of course, the Labs and the German Shepherds are always there. What are you finding most that comes in for training at your place?
The Labradoodles and the Golden Doodles. And, you know, if you get them trained, they are characters, those guys. They have a lot of energy, and they can jump and run, and they grow big quick. Now, some of them are mini. They're not as bad, but they still can be rambunctious, but just like any dog. But they do seem to come in here a lot. I do get a lot of doodles, and they are off the hook a lot of times. And if you get them trained, then they can become a Walt Disney dog. And then, you know, like we trained a doodle the other probably 7 years ago, and we go to these people's house to watch the game, and there they are. The kids are all laying on the dog in front of the TV, and that's just a beautiful thing. And then on the other hand, I had a doodle that was probably had some health issues, probably had some genetic inbreeding that came in here at 16 weeks, and all I did was reach down to touch the puppy, and the puppy turned and bit, held, and ripped. And it's very unusual for a puppy to do something like that. So obviously the puppy was probably overbred or something was going on there, taken from the litter very early. But anyway, I consider that to be a success because the dog bit me and not the grandmother who brought the dog's in children. So I told her, she was crying when she left. I said, hey, you know what? I helped you. You know, now you know that this is not a dog that you can trust. You cannot train that out of a dog, no matter how good you are. That dog, and you, a dog can go and be a friendly dog and be really friendly with people and may not have bite inhibition. You may step on his paw and he may bite and rip, but he's a friendly dog. So it's a pretty deep conversation there when you talk about dog bite inhibition.
So we have just a few more minutes left, Scotty, and I want to get into one of the areas that you spend a lot of time on, and that's reading canine body language. I think that's one of the most important skills that we can learn as dog trainers on what to see and how that recognition in terms of training. What is your method behind that, and maybe give a little bit of advice to clients about what they should be seeing with their dogs?
Well, learning how to read a dog's body language will change the way you view dogs for the rest of your life. You know, you walk into a room, a dog is looking at you hard and looking right at you and doesn't turn away. That's a dog you might want to pay attention to, you know. A dog, you walk in the room, the dog turns away. It's called a look away. Dog will look away, maybe even do a whole body turn away. That's saying I don't mean any harm with you, or lip licking or eye blinking. And then versus maybe you walk over to a dog and you were somehow or another your dog came up by you and you were petting the dog and now the dog freezes with the mouth closed. Sometimes they hold their breath, ears pinned back. So you have to be careful in the reading of a dog because everything in context. A wagging tail does not mean a dog's happy. Usually a tail that goes in a circle most times is a happy dog. But just because that tail is going back and forth, that does not mean that that's a happy dog. Blinking, shake-offs, obsessive scratching, excessive salivation, yawning, lip licking. You know, so when you learn to read a dog, you can kind of trust your dog and you can trust the pack to allow your dog to engage with the pack of dogs because they'll give you lots of signs. You know, a good example is go to the dog park. Don't go to a dog park, but go where there are dogs and walk in and look, see what those dogs are doing when they see your dog. Maybe a dog is standing straight up with straight legs and tail high, looking right at your dog and not looking away. Well, there you go. That's a red flag right there. Maybe you look at the dogs and one of the dogs is lip licking and head turning away. That's a dog that's saying, hey, I mean no harm. But you also want to remember everything in context because the dog, you know, could do one barking. You know, maybe it's a bark that's a true, I'm going to come over and put a bite on you. Or maybe it's a bark of hello and stretching, things like that. Height seeking, jumping up on somebody, that's an act of dominance. Any extreme dog behavior can lead to a dog bite. Extreme submissiveness, extreme dominant can lead to a dog bite. So, one thing that I've been teaching a lot of people and I've been seeing probably about one-fifth of the dogs that come in here as they do what's called a tap-out. And when you go to touch the dog will literally turn their nose and roll into a belly rub, which it's just in my personal opinion that is an antisocial behavior and that can lead to a dog bite. Now, there's a big difference between that and a belly rub. belly rub is when your dog's happy-go-lucky and you come over and the dog kind of lays down and you're rubbing the belly. But if they turn that nose and they're pointing that nose and they roll into that nose and they're kind of stiff about it, and in my opinion, they don't really want to be petted, and that can lead to a dog bite. And I've seen it many times, and I've told people, especially with puppies, come in and I say, don't, your dog's doing a tap out, don't rub his belly, and boom, there it is, he got a bit. You know, probably three times in the last 2 years that I've seen that happen. So a belly rub, a lot of people say, well, yeah, he's always giving me his belly, I'm always rubbing his belly, he's good, he's being submissive. Well, yeah, any extreme behavior, submission, can lead to a dog bite.
Two more points, Scotty, if we can. I like to do this, especially on our mushing show, is giving a point of advice. But I'm going to ask you for two pieces of advice. One piece of advice for the novice dog owner. What was one piece of advice you can give to them? And then another piece of advice, if you can, because I know you work with a lot of people that are becoming dog trainers. What is one piece of advice for them as well?
Well, for the owners, you have to give your dog an adventure. You have to appease the genetics of the canine. Got to get him out there and move him around. You know, you should have a bag full of Kongs and tennis balls and squeaky toys, and wherever you go on your hike, and then you stop and you throw a frisbee, you throw a tennis ball. You have to engage that dog so that when that dog comes home, he sees that as his den, not Chuck E. Cheese. So he comes in and he chills out and he relaxes. That's what I would say. Training, yes, but balancing is what I'm talking about. As far
right.
as a novice dog trainer, well, I would say don't bash other dog trainers. Everybody's right. As long as they're not striking their dog, you know, viciously or anything like that, don't bash other dog trainers, because you can be standing next to a 17-year-old clicker trainer and learn something from that person, and you could be standing next to a 60-year-old e-collar trainer and learn something from that person. So the smart one is the one that keeps their mouth shut and just absorbs all that they can when it comes to dogs, because it's endless. And whenever you hear these old-timers telling their dog stories, that's when the young trainers need to listen, because those stories are lessons, and we learn from those lessons. And I've just been very, very blessed in my life to have experienced so much. There's a great dog trainer in Wisconsin, Robin McFarland, and she once told me many years ago, if you really want to get good with dogs, you need to train as many dogs as you can. And so I did. I trained as many as I could, and I was doing it, you know, 24/7 for probably a good, strong 5 years, and then I took a vacation. Well, the dog taught me a lot. Other trainers have taught me a lot, DVDs, books, but dogs have taught me more than anybody.
I totally agree with you there. Scotty, how do people find out about you? I know you're active on Facebook, or what are some other ways to get in contact with you?
Well, canineponderosa.com, my email is on there, and I am on Facebook. You can click like on the Canine Ponderosa Facebook page. And other than that, it's been good talking to you. One of these days I'm going to come up there and visit you. I see your Facebook, and it looks really beautiful in Alaska.
Well, you do have those mushing videos. Maybe that can give you some inspiration to jump on a plane and come on up.
Yeah, you never know. I might have to do that for our A-reel.
Very cool. Well, Scotty, it was my pleasure. I'll definitely pass along the links, and we can talk about this a little bit more on Facebook if people have questions. I'll make sure I forward them over to you, okay?
Very good, Robert. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.